Hello, welcome to the first episode. I'm Jimmy. I am here to have a cup of tea and a chat with you. We're going to discuss various things. It's all going to be quite loosey-goosey. This is the first episode. We haven't really set a proper format up yet. So we're going to have a little bit of a play around with things. I suggest that you start your listening journey by grabbing yourself a cup of tea or a beverage that you can get hold of and chill out with. I am currently drinking what has become my go-to tea, which is Clipper Earl Grey tea with a splash of milk. Nice middle-of-the-road Earl Grey tea. I think some Earl Grey teas can be a little bit too fragrant. I don't think this one is too fragrant, just a little hint of bergamot oil, bergamot. Depends how you're brought up saying it, doesn't it, I suppose, really? It's not too citrusy. It's quite nice. I have a splash of milk in my Earl Grey. A lot of people get grumpy about that, but I think there should be no judgment in such things. You have your tea, or indeed your coffee, however the heck you want. You drink your caffeinated beverage however makes you happy. Right, let's have a little look at some books. So I thought I would have a little segment in this about books, because I read an awful lot of books. I have to for the YouTube channel that I run. It's called The Welsh Viking, in case you're not already a subscriber. And I read a lot of history books. Popular history, academic history, classic, old, boring, dusty history, all kinds of history books. But currently I am reading a very interesting, more recent history book. It's called The Opium War, and it's by Julia Lovell, who is a professor of modern Chinese history at Birkbeck in the University of London. And this is a book that is a good inch and a bit thick. It's a chunky old tome. It's like 400 odd pages of history, but it's got pictures in it as well. It's got photographs, it's got colour pictures in the middle. It's got three sections of photos, which is always nice. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's quite depressing. Whoops, something's just fallen off my bookshelf, don't worry about that. It's quite humbling. It's quite depressing in parts. So it's a fascinating book. It's also quite humbling in parts, because obviously I come from the UK. I am a Cymro, I'm Welsh, and the UK has played a part in some absolutely atrocious things over the last few hundred years. Not only things like the slave trade, the international slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade that is globally famous, of course, but things like the Opium War, which are much less famous. The Opium War, or the Opium Wars, as it turns out, have had a huge influence on Sino-British relations for the last 200 years. And you don't really appreciate the influence that it's had on foreign policy and politics until you read a book like this. It's a really in-depth book. It goes all the way from before the Opium War was even considered. It talks about the opium trade. It talks about how the opium trade was used as a tool of colonialism and sort of proto-capitalism in the UK and India and in China. And then it does have a sort of blow-by-blow account of the war itself. So if you like war history that's got sort of details of the fighting, there is some of that in it as well. But it's absolutely fascinating. And a subject, like I say, that's not as famous as maybe it should be, considering the influence it's had, considering that during the Opium Wars, China was a very closed-off, quite insular country that has become effectively the workshop of the world that the UK was at the time of, just after the time of the Opium Wars. So quite interesting stuff, quite cool stuff. But yeah, The Opium Wars by Julia Lovell, that's my current history book. It's not dry at all, it's very well written, the narrative is really easy to follow, it's semi-academic, it's obviously written by a professor, so there's good rigour, there's good academic research going on behind it. It's got a huge section of notes and reading lists at the back, which I always like. It's always a good sign if your history book has a big old reading list at the back so that you can criticise their sources and see if you trust the way that their research has been done. It's always a positive sign. Academics like that. We researchers and academics, we like seeing that other researchers and academics are open to you following their paper trail. Always follow the paper trail if you're reading a history book. So that is my history book du jour, which I have been reading with my lovely Earl Grey tea. I also want this podcast to talk about specific historical events. And a very important specific historical event that is happening in 2025 is that it is the 200th anniversary of the railways. Or to be specific, it is the 200th anniversary of mainline passenger railways. And this is the sort of the modern railway. Because in 1825, 200 years ago, the first modern railway was opened to the public. The Stockton and Darlington Railway on the 27th of September 1825. About 500 people, 550 odd people, travelled 27 miles, and they did it in the neck-breaking 15 miles per hour. Incredible. Absolutely unbelievable speeds. Speeds that can only have been imagined before then, unless you had been riding on horses for any length of time. But 27 miles in 1825 in less than 3 hours was pretty darn good. The number of people, fare-paying passengers, that it could transport was the amazing thing here. It was incredible that a locomotive, a steam locomotive, the first passenger journey by steam locomotive, took 500 people. Imagine that you are a late 18th, early 19th century person, and you are used to the most people you can fit into a carriage is, you know, half a dozen, maybe a dozen if there are people on top. 20 or 30 will be able to fit in the big omnibuses in London soon enough. But beyond that, we're talking about multiple carriages with dozens of horses, or a large boat or a ship. And now you can do it with these newfangled railways. Absolutely incredible. Now, this is the first modern railway. The first paying railway, first paid railway, was the Swansea and Mumbles Railway in South Wales. But the difference with that is they were still using horses. So the first modern railway was the Stockton and Darlington Railway in the northeast of England. The Swansea and Mumbles was built in 1804. And if you have a look at pictures of the Swansea and Mumbles Railway, you can see photographs of the horse-drawn trams that were still being used 75 years later in the 1890s. They were still using horse-drawn trams. And they did try to do some preservation on it. They tried to do a bit of preservation on some of the cars, some of the tram cars. Unfortunately, one of them was damaged and vandalised in Leeds, but one was preserved in Swansea in the museum, and it is now much, much happier, and is in its tram shed in Swansea. So the first modern railway 200 years ago, which is an incredible amount of time to think that we've had railways for, right? We think of railways as this thing that really took off in the late 19th and 20th centuries. We think, oh yeah, trains are a modern thing. Trains are something that our dads and granddads and grandmas had. But, you know, our great, great, great grandparents were living in an age where there were railways. 1804. First paid passenger railway, 1804, imagine that. That's 221 years ago. But there are loads of things happening across Britain's railways to celebrate this 200th anniversary, including 50% off rail fares for, I think, 2 months. After that, they're going back to their normal price, plus another 6%. So it's not a great option. It's not the best way possibly to celebrate this incredibly momentous time for the most environmentally friendly form of mass transit that we've developed so far as a species. I'm holding out for teleport. I'm holding out for Transmat, or whatever you want to call it, for transporter beams. But so far, trains is what we got. And it just so happens that I'm actually drinking my Earl Grey tea from a mug with a steam engine on it. How's that for topical? Now, the first few decades of the railways, some of you guys might already know this, but the first few decades of the railways were an explosion. This is a time where this new technology, this steam technology, is being embraced. It's being improved. They're making improvements to the steam engines. They're making steam engines that can go faster, that can pull heavier loads. It's a time where they are directly competing with the canals, and frankly, beating the canals into the dust with how fast the progress is going. So that by the 1840s and 1850s, there is a railway network in the UK, and further abroad, by the 1860s, we have railways being built across North America, we have railways all over Europe, so that by the 1880s, just 60 years after, less than a full human lifetime after the Stockton and Darlington Railway starts with 27 miles, there are tens of thousands of miles of railway track in Europe, hundreds of thousands, in fact, and millions of people are being transported by train every year. And this is the time where the railways start to also empower people a lot more, because train tickets could be really cheap. You could go a long way for a penny. So people were, for the first time ever, in some cases, travelling out of their area. They were travelling out of their county or out of their country, even, by train. We have all of these stories from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Think of things like Arthur Conan Doyle or Agatha Christie. How many of those books and stories involve train travel? Because people really embraced the democratization that rail travel brought them. It brought a standardized timing as well. Prior to that, clocks weren't all set to exactly the same times in different parts, even of the UK. So you would get to Scotland, for example, from London, and everybody would be 5 minutes later. And railway time united that. So all of this really cool stuff started 200 years ago in 1825 in Stockton-on-Tees in the northeast of England, in a mining area, a coal mining area, where basically the railways, like in South Wales with the Swansea and Mumbles Railway, with Richard Trevithick at Penydarren, really looked into this new technology as a way of transporting not just raw materials like coal, but also people to and from work. And they're still here today. And frankly, if you want my honest opinion, I think they could do with a little bit more TLC and maybe renationalising, but that's straying a little bit into politics. Ooh. Now, some of you may know this already, some of you probably don't know this, but I love railways and railway history. I used to work on a steam railway. I grew up in North Wales, so we have the Great Little Trains of Wales on my doorstep. We had things like the Llanberis Lake Railway, Snowdon Mountain Railway, the Welsh Highland Railway, the Festiniog Railway, the Bala Lake Railway, the Talysin Railway, the Welsh Pool and Llanfair Railway. We also have the Llangollen Railway, which is a standard gauge railway. There's Rhyl Miniature Railway, there's a Pontypool and Blaenavon Railway, the Gwyli Railway. We've got a lot of railways in Wales, a lot of preserved steam railways, heritage railways, we might call them. Right now I live in York, so we have the North York Moors Railway, the Middleton Railway, the Wensleydale Railway. There are lots of railways in the UK. In fact, the UK is probably the place for railway preservation. There is a big industry, and I mean industry, of railway heritage in the UK. We have companies that are dedicated to rebuilding steam engines. We have companies that are dedicated to providing heritage clothing for people who work on the steam engines. And the majority of these railways are volunteer run. The problem that a lot of railways are having as we enter the 200th year is a lot of their workforces are aging. A lot of the guys who set these railways up, and they are usually white men, set them up in the 1970s when a lot of branch lines had just been shut, steam had just ended in 1968, they stopped using steam trains in the UK, and this is them kind of building their nostalgic giant toy train set, right? This is a model railway writ large, and the problem is a lot of these guys are now in their 70s, 80s, 90s, even entering their hundreds, and the number of younger volunteers just isn't enough in some places to keep them going. There are railways like the North York Moors Railway that have apprenticeship schemes. They have training for young people in mechanical engineering and woodworking and carriage painting and all sorts of things to try and keep these skills going. And the Bowness and Kinneil Railway in Scotland is also trying to get more young people involved with apprenticeship schemes and paid positions. So, if the idea of the 200th anniversary of the railways has kind of tickled your fancy a bit, why not have a look into volunteering at your local heritage railway, or just paying a visit to a local heritage railway, because they could use the dough. I'm not going to lie, they could use the extra pennies. So that's enough about volunteering and the state of the volunteer sector in the UK. This is our pilot podcast episode, so obviously it has been ever so slightly chaotic and maybe a little light, but next time I am going to have company. I'm going to have somebody with me, and we are going to discuss either a specific year and place or historical anniversary that they think we should talk about on the podcast. So I hope you'll join me for that, and I hope that with future episodes we will ask the Patreon, so if you're on the Welsh Viking Patreon, we will probably be asking you guys if you have a specific year and place or historical anniversary that you think should be discussed and broadcast a little bit, which will then be discussed on the podcast. And these episodes will probably go out onto YouTube as well. But for now, I hope that you have enjoyed a lovely cup of tea with me. I hope that you have enjoyed this first episode and that you like the idea of this podcast and the format. And I will say, diolch yn fawr iawn I chi gyd. Thank you very much to all of you for listening. Am wrando, diolch am wrando. And I will say, tan y tro nesa, till the next time, hwyl am y tro. Bye-bye for now. The Welsh Viking Podcast was narrated by Jimmy Johnson, produced by Jimmy Johnson, edited by Jimmy Johnson, and features music by Inaban. It was a Jimmy Johnson production for The Welsh Viking / Jimmy Johnson. Basically, I did this.